The Security Committee is now in session. Terry, would you do the roll call?
Chair McMichael?
Here.
Vice Chair Boylan?
Aye.
Regent Brooks?
Here.
Regent Carter?
Here.
Regent Tarkanian?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. We will move to agenda item number one. Public comment. Do we have any public comment in Elko?
There is none.
No public comment in Elko. Public comment in Reno?
There is none.
No public comment in Reno. Do we have public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none. We will move on to agenda item number two, consent item, and which includes A, minutes. Do I have a motion? A motion for approval from Regent Borland. Do I have
second.
A second?
Second.
And second from Regent, Tarkanian. I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay, we will move on to agenda item. And we will go ahead and vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. And we will move on to the treasurer's report. I'm sorry, the chair's report. Is that three?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Agenda item number three. Man, right there. The chair's report. And I wish to welcome Chief Adam Garcia and Chief Eric James from the North and South Commands. And we will move on to item number three. Item number four, excuse me. I must be on the wrong. There we are. All right. Agenda item number four, enterprise risk management, and this is information only. And we have Chief Garcia.
Good morning, Chair McMichael, Vice Chair Boylan, committee members, presidents, colleagues, students. First, let me apologize for my voice. I'm just getting over whatever I had for a couple weeks, but I promise you I'm not contagious. So, good morning. For the record, my name is Adam Garcia, Vice President of Public Safety Services and Director of University Police Southern Command. I also serve as the interim chair of the NC COVID Task Force. I was asked to make this presentation in the vein of what are we going to do if we have another event like a COVID pandemic. And so I'm going to be providing you with a brief overview of enterprise risk management and continuity of operations planning, the processes and the protocols that go along with that. Lisa Schaller, Executive Director of Risk Management and Insurance Management for ENSHI, and Christy Roberson, Assistant Director of Risk Management and Insurance Management for ENSHI, are in Reno, and they are going to be available to assist me in answering any questions that you may have when I'm done. In addition, I'm joined here by my colleague, Dr. Amanda Wines, Manager of Organizational Resilience for UNR, GBC, WNC, and DRI. She will provide information regarding high-risk threats, which have a potential to impact all of our institutions. And Jeff Ohs, who's the Interim Assistant Director for Emergency Management, Southern Command, he will discuss the steps involved in emergency management and the integration with our institutions of training protocols. Enterprise risk management is a strategic alignment framework that's used to identify, assess, respond, control, and communicate risks. The risks can really be broken out, as you see in your slide to the right here. Hazard risks includes property, legal, personal, and consequential loss. Operational risk looks at people, IT and business processes. Strategic risk includes economic, political, and social risks, and so on. By assessing and looking at each one of these different areas, we can get a holistic view across all the functional areas that helps us and you, quite frankly, in identifying and prioritizing treatments like risk avoidance, retaining acceptable risk, sharing or transferring risk through insurance, and loss prevention and reduction. Enterprise risk management framework supports identifying key stakeholders and subject matter experts who own and treat their own respective risks in a manner that aligns with our threshold for risk. So where's our risk? What are we willing to accept? So we set that in identifying it. It also assists with developing and defining communication in governance structures for identification, prioritization, and treatment of those risks that we're willing to take. The current model that we use in ENSHE in risk management, our structures and processes, it really are very differently from institution to institution. Collectively, we all practice traditional risk management, which really, and I don't mean to be offensive here, tends to be more reactive and focused on procurement of insurance to transfer the risk in mitigation or abatement that's used on incidents or tasks. So the COVID pandemic was an example of ENSHE informally applying enterprise risk management frameworks as we engaged risk owners and stakeholders system-wide. This was used to mitigate and treat the risk based on institutional and system leadership strategy and our own risk tolerance levels, as I talked a minute ago. In a nutshell, what we did is what you see in this slide. We scanned the environment, we identified the risks, we analyzed the risks, we treated the risks, and monitored and assured risk treatments were effective. In a classic definition of what enterprise risk management is, that's what we did. And this is what that looks like in this slide. This slide provides examples of the governance structures with the Board of Regents at the very top of this pyramid, providing system-wide strategic initiatives and objectives. The next slide includes ENSHE Cabinet and business officers who provide direction and guidance as needed. In the orange level you see here, ENSHE Emergency and Risk Management identifies, assesses, and mitigates system-wide risks through validation and prioritization. The next layer, ENSHE Emergency and Risk Management identifies, assesses, and mitigates the system-wide risks that we face that's in alignment with what the board sets out at the very top of this pyramid. And finally, in the bottom layer, this is where individual campuses identify, assess, and mitigate their risks in alignment with what's set out in the system-wide objectives in the top of this this pyramid. And in another way of doing this, as you can see in this inverted pyramid, NC Leadership provides the strategic initiatives through enterprise risk management processes and protocols, through emergency management and risk management, and onto individual campuses. This campus, as I discussed a minute ago, was used very informally during the COVID pandemic, as well as the UNR dorm explosion. Moving forward, the intent here is to formally implement this emergency risk management framework. So where it's kind of like going to IKEA and buying something that you have to put together, and like many people, I just put it together. I don't read the instructions until it's too late, and then I have to go back. So that's what we're doing, is we're creating kind of this instructions on how things are going to do. If I'm gone tomorrow, we're gone tomorrow, and there's a new board, new people, it's going to be there. It's going to tell them and guide them how we're going to move forward. I'm working with Director Schaller in seeking grant funding as well for implementation of a system-wide continuity of operations plan, which is required by NRS, by the way. We're going to be working hand-in-hand in doing this, and it does dovetail very nicely with enterprise risk management as well. I am very, very confident. I've spoken to the folks who supplied this grant funding, and I'm very, very confident that we'll be awarded the funding, and hopefully at a future meeting I can discuss the grant award and how we're going to move forward at doing this at the system level. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Wines, who's going to discuss her portion of this presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Amanda Wins, Organizational Resilience Manager. Why it is so important currently to start looking at resilience? The pandemic has demonstrated events and incidents definitely have the ability to impact all institutions and all aspects of our lives. Unfortunately, as this graph shows, the trend of billion-dollar disaster frequencies is increasing across the United States, and honestly, globally as well. This morning, I'm going to discuss some high-risk threats. And what makes these threats high-risk is that they are not contained to a very small geographic area. These impacts will be felt across our state, across our nation, and especially on that human level. Okay? A disaster isn't a disaster unless something is happening to the people that are incorporated within the area. There's also long-term cascading consequences. These are not issues that can be solved quickly or can be solved rapidly, but yet we'll see as a society these impacts lasting for a long term. Also, the incidents that I'm going to discuss, we have limited capabilities and or time. These incidents aren't ones that kind of grow slowly, and we have time to prepare. But a lot of these incidents are going to happen suddenly or without notice, and that we are going to be faced dealing with them with the resources and the training that we have at hand. Okay. Our first instance is drought. Nevada is one of the most arid states within the nation. Currently, there is not an individual within Nevada that is not impacted by drought. We've seen the water restrictions in Las Vegas specifically. Our agricultural productions have been very slowed down by drought. As, of course, our wildfire season is now no longer a season, but more of a 12-month-a-year possibility. Cyber attacks have been an extreme increase. There's been about a 75% increase, specifically to institutions of higher education. A lot of that does have to do with all of us moving from the pandemic to incorporate new technology into doing more remote learning platforms and assuring that all of our students, staff, faculties, researchers have the access to technology that they need. That has provided access for actors to exploit those vulnerabilities and capabilities. Unfortunately, this is not a risk that we're going to see decrease, and in fact, it's going to be continuing to increase. Governor Sisolak has created a new cybersecurity infrastructure program to assist the state, as unfortunately Nevada is one of the states that has been seeing a lot more cyber crime activity. Nevada is also the third most seismically active state. We have not seen a large earthquake in mainland United States. However, around the entire Pacific Rim, there has been a 7.0 earthquake within the past 5 years everywhere except for on the mainland U.S. We are overdue to have a very significant seismic event. While we have done a lot of seismic retrofits on a lot of our historical buildings, we still have a lot of those unreinforced masonry buildings that are very vulnerable to damage from any seismic activity. There's also an extremely large potential for a loss of critical infrastructure, such as our communications, water, et cetera, that occurs with a seismic event. Since this would be so geographically widespread, again, this is not something we can solve in a week, in a month. It will take years to rebuild from. The last threat is from wildfires. And wildfires goes far beyond just from an actual burning and flame incident that we need to protect our infrastructure from. It goes into the smoke hazards, as well as supporting other communities that might be impacted by wildfires and offering them mass care and sheltering operations from neighboring states. Currently, Nevada and California are working on a lot of plans to be able to either support California communities or support Nevada communities in case they are impacted. This would definitely the smoke impacts on the air quality has definitely impacted institutional operations in the past few years. And as our wildfire risk increases, we will see that going forward. There's also the potential for another human-caused pandemic. Right now, we're in an era of globalization and ease of travel that really the human experience has never seen before. The United States has definitely demonstrated that we do have an over-dependence on just-in-time logistics, and I'm sure not only professionally, but probably on a personal level as well, everyone in here has been impacted by supply chain breaks within the past few years. Not only is there the actual disease and healthcare issues coming from the pandemic, but also there's been seeing a very significant increase in mental health crisis. Our essential worker turnover has been extreme in the past few years, so we no longer have that really long-term historic education and experience, especially for a lot of our response agencies and healthcare industries that traditionally we have had. The long-term impacts economically still probably are not fully realized from the last pandemic as well. Okay. So those are the risks that we're facing. And strategic priorities to build resilience. We need to help build that culture of preparedness. We need to be proactive instead of reactive. We need to embrace prevention and mitigation. Every year that there's a study that comes out by the National Building and Science Institute, and currently their research shows that by embracing prevention and mitigation, if you spend $1 to stop something from happening or to reduce the impacts, you actually save over $11 in the recovery phase. So this is truly why we need to focus on reduction of impacts versus just having those reactions after something happens. We need to advance, as emergency management advances, we need to adhere to professional best practices, and including offering the state-of-the-art training, not just specifically for people who might be traditional responders, such as law enforcement, but also people who are going to be in charge of making those decisions when there are institutional impacts and continual, and their continuing impacts to all of our entire communities. Okay. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Jeff Ose. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff Ose. Thanks for the opportunity to share this information. So you've seen this, what that word resilience and what that means to us, and how do, the big thing is, how do we get there? How do we get back to what we used to know? And we'll talk about that a little bit more in depth here in a second. But the steps of emergency management are there on that wheel. And each one of those steps is interdependent upon itself and depends on one another. What we do with these steps is we identify, estimate, and validate our capabilities. And what that means is that we look at ourselves, we look at what we're able to provide to the community that we serve, we look at how well we're prepared, how well we interact with our first responder agencies, and how well we can move forward. And when we identify those gaps, we need to bring those up to the front, and we need to solve those gaps so when the disaster or the incident does occur, we're not left short holding the bag and still dealing with those gaps. The recognition and the utilization of the all-hazard approach is very, very important in this aspect. In my former career as a fireman in California, we do a lot of all-hazard and all-risk training, and we do that for a purpose. So when anyone walks into the room, we have a basic concept of what everyone else is doing. We're all kind of on the same page. Firefighters all pull hose, raise ladders, do all those things in basically the same elements. Are there little tweaks? Absolutely. And we're not talking about doing away with the little tweaks that are effective for your local community. For example, we wouldn't probably need snowplows down here in Las Vegas, but they are going to need them in the North State. But we may have somebody down here in Las Vegas that knows how to operate a snowplow, and we would be able to share that person with the North State should they have that need. So resilience is the ability to withstand the adversity, and it's the capacity to recover from that difficulty. How do we get back to whatever it was? We're never going to get back to normal. Once the incident occurs, that portion of normal is gone. We've moved forward from it, but it's our ability to get back to as close to that as we can. We know we will always have fallouts. We will never be able to go back to the minute before the disaster occurs. But the better prepared we are, the better trained we are, the greater realization of us getting back to as close to that as we can, that's where it becomes key to our preparation. So the intent and the why: protect lives, protect property, recover costs, recover time, and reduce the chaos by some level. The more prepared you are, the better off you are. If you stay prepared, you don't have to get prepared. If you practice like you play, you'll play better on Sundays. All those cliches apply to this. Right? If we sit back and we just let these things happen, and we know that there's gaps that have been identified and we fail to address them, that's our fault. Right? We have no excuse for that. We must continue to move forward with our preparation and our training in order to accomplish these goals. So how we get there? Another great graphic from FEMA and NIMS and the preparedness cycle. And you can see, again, all of these concepts rely on each other and they're independent of each other. So the planning process. When we look at events like NFR, we evaluate the people, the number of people that are going to be there, what the crowd's going to look like, what the parking problems are going to be, access, all those types of things, and we develop a plan. We do these for all large-scale events. We need to get this as more of a routine for our everyday events. That gives us the practice. So when an emergency occurs or an incident occurs, we know what steps we're going to take. We've been through the steps through the planning process. We know which forms to use. We know who's going to be in charge. We know what role each other is going to play, so on and so forth. That level of engagement is very, very important because, again, if we fail to do that, planning to fail or failure to plan is planning to fail, right? If we don't take advantage of those situations and those scenarios where we can make ourselves better, we're doing ourselves and we're doing the community a disservice. Training and exercise becomes very, very important. As I mentioned about the snowfall between the North and the South State, we might have people down here that are trained that can go up to the North State, and the North State may have people that they can share down here. If we're all trained to the same level, we all have the same level of responsibility, and we know what our job tasks are, we put those in training and exercise modalities, and we learn more about each other, and we learn more ways to get better. So, for example, We're currently building a tabletop exercise. We're starting with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I won't disclose the type of exercise, but it's going to involve risk management, Office of Emergency Management, business and marketing, and senior leadership. And it's going to be a big deal. But the idea is to get people informed about what their responsibilities are and how they should be reacting when an incident, when a real incident comes along. That identifies those roles and responsibilities ahead of time that you maybe didn't know you had. Or it gives you the opportunity to identify somebody in your shop or in your office to take on those roles and responsibilities. We've also become more familiar with the tools and the templates, how to use these forms, how to use the formats, how to stay on time, how to write good objectives, how to accomplish our goal and get back to as close to that normal as we can. Obviously, we want to get better. So this is how we train. Another great graphic, all interdependent on each other. We take that all-hazard and all-risk approach. We emphasize the importance of the objectives and validating them. Remember that objectives are specific to the incident, to the incident or the scenario that is occurring at that time. And once we accomplish those objectives, we can build another objective, or we scratch it on the list and we've come closer to accomplishing our goals. Process is a big word. And the reason it's a big word is because we don't want to let the incident distract from what needs to be done. So if we need to take care of feeding our students off-site or housing them off-site, we can't let something else come along and distract us from making sure those things occur. So staying on process, keeping you on task, right, running those plays over and over and over again with throwing little injects in as a distractor, The more commonplace those are, the better prepared you are, and the more you stay on task to accomplish those goals. The team and the role of senior leadership are obviously very, very important. Those two elements of this process set the table for how well we're going to exceed, how well we're trained, how well we can move forward once the incident occurs. And then the exercising of the continuity of operations plan, that all folds it all together. If you don't have a continuity of operations plan, or your continuity of operations plan hasn't been reviewed in the last few years, I implore you to do so, right? Change of personnel, change of phone numbers, change of office locations, all those things become, they look like they're little on paper, but when an incident occurs and we're looking around for somebody to do a job and we can't find them or we don't have their phone number to get a hold of them, we're going to fail. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. So what we train on, we typically use the incident command system. The system was born out of the fire service in the 1970s in the state of California, and it's prospered itself all the way up to being a nationally backed program through FEMA, Emergency Management Institute, and the National Incident Management System. It's a widespread, widely used component that teaches everybody the same things, the same foundational skill set, the same learning capabilities on every single level. And there's varying levels. All staff should be trained to a certain level. As you move higher up in your, quote, food chain, you should have more site-specific or position-specific training in order for you to function at that level. And then again, as you continue to rise up, those leadership classes, those ability to take control of a bad situation and lead the group through the incident becomes very, very imperative. I've been on a number of incidents where the term controlled chaos is an understatement, and it takes a great leader to come in and put their hand up and say, hey, everybody, let's just do our job. Those words are very, very soothing. They're very soothing to the people that are employed in trying to solve the problem, and they're very soothing to the public because it gives them confidence in you. That's all I have. Thank you again for the opportunity, and we'll open the floor up to any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, and maybe Mr. Rose or the entire team, and maybe it's from watching Jurassic Park again, but it is kind of the chaos theory in looking at responding to natural disasters. I know I was on a plane with former Governor Sandoval years ago during a December windstorm and a December fire, which we'd never seen before. And I know this valley has been planning on flooding for decades, with retention basins and putting in channels. And just a few weeks ago, just watching the cars stuck in the streets. And kind of the chaos side is I think all the planning structure has been based on how things have worked and responded in the past. And as you mentioned, the Forest Service model, and you get everybody in the room and who does this and who does what. But with climate change, we don't know what's happening next. And it's a lot more reactionary to what could be out there. And I'm just wondering, in your planning processes, how do you try and look forward, or how do you try and engage with that? Or you just try and keep it all in, you do your role. It doesn't matter why we've got this big flood coming. This is how we're all supposed to address the flood. But are there things that you all could be doing or recommending to the governing agencies that they could be doing? I know up north I've seen them cutting down more timber around power lines to try and decrease the chance of fire. But I'm just curious how you're adapting, because it doesn't seem like it's – I've been part of the process for 20 years. It doesn't seem like it's changed much. You've got control and command, and it's very clear how things go, but it's just changing, and I'm not sure how to address it. I'm just curious.
Understood. And to answer your question, I think in the short term is it's a little bit of both. We want people to stay on process and on task for the job that they're assigned, but we also look forward on an annual basis with a workshop that we do to identify those hazards and risks. And another cliche that we use is the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, right? So we can look back at our past year and say, okay, what did we encounter over the past year that had an impact on our community and the people that we serve? And we'll note, you know, extreme heat and seismic activity, as Dr. Wines mentioned, and those things that are common down here. And we'll kick it up a little bit and say, okay, well, we had 10 consecutive days of extreme heat over 115 degrees. Let's design an exercise where it's 25 days. Let's design an exercise where there's an inject where we have a grid failure of the power system, and we're not able to just put people in casinos or put them in Thomas and Mack Center for cooling stations. So we take those elements, and we have to be careful when we do the exercises, because we want to design them to challenge the people that are involved in the exercises, but we don't want to push them over the top to where they become disengaged and disenfranchised. Because if we throw the book at them and we're trying to derail them, we're not doing anybody any good, right? They're not going to, I don't want to say enjoy, but they're not going to enjoy what they're doing, and it's a bad reflection on us as well. So we tailor make those exercises and those training modalities to fit the need of the public, and some of it, yes, is based on what we just saw. Now, your mention of the cutting the trees in the north part of the state, that's part of the mitigation and planning process and preparation process, right? When we identify those hazards and we say, you know, we had a significant flooding event outside of the flood control channels and wherever, we look at that and we say, okay, what measures can we take ahead of time to maybe make those flood channels work better? So when we know, when we get the information that a storm is coming, instead of the day before sending people out to mitigate some problems, we send them out 3 days before or as soon as we get that information. So it's kind of a balance of both. Again, they're both kind of interdependent on each other. If we focus on one side too much, we lose track of what's going on with the other. And I hope I answered your question adequately.
Thank you. And mostly I just, and thank you, Ms. Chair. It's changing so rapidly. I'm not sure that the procedures and processes that we have are keeping up, but maybe they are.
And that's the emphasis of the continued training and exercise, is that if we're continuously greasing the wheels of preparation, we'll adapt to whatever it is we have to adapt to.
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Regent.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Great information. I'm just curious, have you done any tabletop exercises with students involved and with other staff members for anything like active shooter or, you know, what have we done? Are we aware of something like that?
Yeah, so here in Southern Command, it's a twofold approach with us in risk management. So UNLV Risk Management offers Stop the Bleed and CPR training, while UPD Southern Command offers a general safety and active shooter training for staff and students. We also just hosted an event at Nevada State College where it was a more integrated and active, hands-on approach to active shooter, and that was geared towards staff, faculty, and students as well.
That's good to know. One more question, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Do we have some sort of mass, should we say, communication? And I know the main thing is, you know, cell phones, blah, blah, blah. And we can get in touch with everybody, send out, you know, if there's an active shooter or a terrorist attack. But do we have any PA systems in our colleges and universities that could make announcements for students and staff that there's something going on?
I'll let Director Garcia answer that, but to the short term is yes.
Oh, good. Good.
For the record, Adam Garcia, thank you for that question. Actually, we're a little bit ahead of ourselves because that's in the next presentation.
Oh, all right. No,
absolutely. We have various, both north and south, we have various redundant systems in which we can provide communications. As you may recall, several years ago, I helped the system write a policy in which it's an opt-out system. So everybody who comes here and registers for classes or gets employed here, they have to provide us with some kind of contact information. So we can contact them through text messaging, which we do, and I'll talk a little bit about that in my next presentation, through email, through phones, through the phone tower systems. We've now integrated, at least in the South, we've integrated the TVs in all of the dorms into our emergency communication processes, as well as a computer. So if we were to have an event right now, this instant, the computer screens that you see in front of you will automatically give the emergency notification sound, as you're familiar with, and then the information will be on there. So it goes to all the classrooms across the board, very redundant systems.
Thank you so much. Good to hear.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd just like to address the training that we are holding for the Northern Command, UNR, WNC, Great Basin, and as well as DRI North. We do hold two tabletop exercises every year. That includes all of our senior leadership, deans, subject matter experts, et cetera. As far as our student engagement, we also have training available, mainly situational awareness, active shooter, active assailant, and that is open to anyone within our university communities as well. We also integrate very closely with all of our regional partners, which includes Washoe County, the City of Reno, City of Sparks, Reno-Sparks Indian Colony, and Lake Pyramid Paiute Tribe, and Washoe County School District as well, where we do a lot of regional planning to make sure that we're integrating all of our efforts so that we do have that standardization when there is a very large incident that occurs, that we can backfill those positions, that we can be resources for others, as well as everyone can assist us, such as we host tours for the fire departments, for our law enforcement agencies on all of our campuses to get them more acquainted. We do attend any training and exercises that the county or one of our other regional partners host, so that we are really getting that integration, that networking, and relationships built ahead of time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. I wanted to emphasize one more thing to your question, sir. The importance of communication internally is huge, and that's part of that continuity of operations plan. So not only having it documented someplace in the plan, but setting up a text group with the people in your office or within your shop, as we refer to them, right? So you have that ability to communicate. You have to know how to get a hold of them, and you have to get that positive feedback that they are, in fact, accounted for.
Do we have any other questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, Dale Arquiaga, Acting Chancellor. I just want to express my gratitude to you for bringing this item and having us think about heaven forbid, another pandemic planning. And at the same time, I wish to express my appreciation to Vice President Garcia and to Executive Director Schaller, who works at the system office. They have stepped into the leadership role of the COVID task force, was previously chaired by General Counsel. And this, I think, is a more appropriate elevation. But that task force, I also wish to acknowledge, we're in a phase now where the experts tell me we are moving from pandemic to endemic. And so what that task force will be doing, I think, is maybe going first in some of this continuity of governance planning as we sort of wind down that task force from a response and mitigation perspective to now one of preparedness so that we are ready should something occur. So I wanted you to know that that's sort of where we are with that task force, and I wish to express my appreciation to Vice President Garcia and Executive Director Schaller.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead, Regent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is for Mr. O. You mentioned that you've done a large-scale tabletop exercise here, or you will be doing one for here at UNLV. What are your plans for the other institutions? Do you have them on schedule yet?
They're not calendared yet, but one of the capabilities that we look at is when we do an exercise, is we look at how we can apply it to the other institutions. Obviously, we have to go to those institutions individually to look for their specific objectives about what it is they want to exercise. This first one is unique to UNLV. That's why we chose them first. And we're also partnering with the FBI to meet some of their response needs as well.
Thank you. I think that this exercise would be a great for all of our institutions, so thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I don't know if we are getting confused by the term tabletop exercise. You cannot have a large-scale tabletop exercise because it's a tabletop exercise. You could have the exercise after that. So what were you letting us know about this?
So,
are we having the exercise, or are you just going to do many tabletop exercises?
Well, we're going to do both. And when we say large-scale tabletop exercises, we can build them to be 8 hours long. And I don't think there's anybody in this room, myself included, that wants to sit at a table and hash out a bunch of stuff for 8 hours.
Right.
We've found that the two-hour increment is better suited for levels of engagement, levels of reinforcement, and levels of learning.
Right.
So we look at those components to build the exercises themselves. The one that we're building for UNLV, because there are so many different departments within UNLV as well as outside agencies that are involved, it's considered a larger scale because of those reasons. And then, like I said, we'll take the components of that exercise, we'll tweak them for the individual institutions and campuses, and then reapply them in the same aspect.
Thank you. Outstanding. Thank
yes. Regent Geddes, you had your hand up.
I was just letting them know that we all sit here for 8 hours at a time, at a tabletop.
My apologies.
I have one question. Because cyber attacks happen on a daily basis, are we adequately covered as far as the financial cost of attacks throughout the year?
Adam Garcia, for the record, I believe that Executive Director Schaller has that information, if she's still in Reno.
Good morning. For the record, Lisa Schaller, Executive Director of Risk and Insurance Management. And to answer your question, yes, we are covered through self-insurance and insurance for cyber. We are currently working through our renewal process that the effective date is in February. So we're meeting with our insurance brokers and the insurance carriers now to establish a policy that could cover all institutions to transfer the risk. So did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, we'll move on to agenda item 5, University Police Services Consolidation. And James Martinez.
Morning, Regents, Chair. This is an information-only item, and the purpose of it is to just provide the board and brief overview of the history of how we got here and have Director Garcia and Director James give brief overviews on the police consolidation efforts and implementation measures that have taken in their respective jurisdictions. So I will start just by giving a brief overview. In 2018, the board retained the services of the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators. We call it ICLEA for short. To provide guidance on police consolidation efforts. So this was in 2018. At that time, there was already a consolidation in the North that had taken place in 2016. The IACLEA report is in the back of material, but they did say that the 2016 consolidation in the North was a success. They gave some additional enhancement measures that they recommended. They also recommended the consolidation guidelines for the southern jurisdiction. And they also recommended a statewide consolidation to follow that for a police commissioner position to consolidate as a state. Obviously, the North consolidation and the South consolidation are complete. What this board has not yet considered is consolidation at a state level. So while this is information only and system administration doesn't have a recommendation either way, and it is information only, we are going to have the directors give you updates and overviews on the effort, the consolidation efforts in their respective jurisdictions, and then just ask for any feedback for what the board would like us to do next, if anything at all. So with that, I will turn it over to Director Garcia or Director James, whoever wants to go first.
Good morning, Chair McMichael, Vice Chair Boylan, committee members, presidents and colleagues and students. For the record, my name is Adam Garcia, Vice President, Public Safety Services and Director of University Police Southern Command. I'll be providing a brief update on the current status of safety, security and law enforcement on our campuses in the South, as well as the status of the consolidation process that we began in Reno in 2016 and in Las Vegas in 2019. Before I move on, I wanted to acknowledge Dr. Edith Fernandez from Nevada State College, who's here, who we've been working over the last 3.5 years since my appointment at Nevada State with police matters, and Amy Evaluna, who is also here, and she is the chair of our police advisory board. So just wanted to acknowledge them. Before I move on, kind of dovetailing on what Attorney Martinez had just discussed, I wanted to provide a very, very brief historical perspective of how we arrived here in terms of public safety consolidation. As many of you know, I've been with the system for 21 years in February, so I've been here throughout. Upon my appointment as chief at the University of Nevada, Reno, in 2002, the concept and discussion regarding shared or consolidated police services was discussed almost immediately in really a variety of formats, as you see here, studies, reports. The first proposal was created and presented in 2003, shortly after my arrival. Ultimately, that proposal was rejected by TMCC's president and police chief at the time. And there are various studies that were undertaken in 2003, again in 2004, that eventually led to a proposal in 2014 for coordination of police services at UNR and TMCC. The concept was adopted. However, eventually it was abandoned, is not workable. This then led to the eventual successful consolidation of UNR and TMCC's police departments in 2016 and the successful consolidation of CSN and UNLV's police department in 2019. I should note that during my research for this presentation, I came on some very interesting facts. I went back to the very, very beginning, the first appointment of a special police officer to the UNR campus was in August of 1901. So that's how far back kind of the engagement with law enforcement takes place. The selection of a night watchman was made by this board, not this board, but that board, of a night watchman in 1909. And he was paid $60 a month. Luckily, I was paid a little bit more when I came here. So today, the Southern Command consolidation continues to mature. Plans are actively ongoing for a fully staffed regional substation in the medical district to serve the new medical education campus, the dental school, and other areas of concern in that area. Tentatively, we're planning to have that substation operational by the end of this fiscal year. Preliminary planning and discussion is ongoing internally within the department to find funding to fully staff a functional substation in Nevada State College. We have already received funding through a grant for a life scan, a fingerprint machine at this substation once it's up and operational. And I hope to have an update on this location in time for our next meeting. The department continues to work with CSN facilities management on the direction and possible remodel or location of the CSN substation in North Las Vegas. In addition, we're continuing to work with CSN to redirect camera monitoring security dispatch from the West Charleston campus to the department's central dispatch at police headquarters. In light of the Uvalde, Texas shooting and other events, the department is in the process of acquiring additional tools that I believe are necessary, as well as training that will be necessary in the event of a critical active, in the event of an active shooter or other critical event. The lessons that we learned from Uvalde and these other locations continue to serve us as guiding mechanisms as our training and our response protocols continue to evolve to meet the changing dynamics of the times in which we live. As you can see from this slide, year to date, our dispatch calls are up approximately 8%. We handle about 4,100 calls a month. Radio transmissions are about 700,000. And again, this is a little outdated because the material has to be provided by October, so this is sometime in September. As you may recall from my presentation last year, we have approximately over a million calls radio transmissions, I should say, every year. So we're on target to do that again this year. Our calls to service, as you can see from the slide, 2020, 11,946, 2021, 13,037, and as of September 30th, 10,158. So we're generally speaking in the ballpark. All calls, 65,277 in 2020, 2021, 64,012, and as of September 30th, 35,290. We have a average response time for our department is 1 minute, 10 seconds to 3 minute, 12 seconds. And again, these are averages, so there's a lot that goes on beyond this. In this three-year comparison, I'll be quick on this one. When we look at this, again, we're on par. When we look at 2020, 2021, in year or till September 30th for 2022, we continue to basically follow the same format each year. We're not increasing numbers substantially, but also we're not decreasing those numbers as well. And we had talked about this a little bit ago Regent Boylan, in which how do we get notifications out? As it relates to those notifications, emergency notifications to all of our campuses, we have provided about 30 emergency notifications since I was appointed in 2019 to all of the Southern Nevada institutions. Our latest October test that took place reached 78,000 mobile phones through text messaging, over 150,000 emails, 93 blue light tower activations, and over 5,000 computer screen activations. I talked about that, you know, the alert will come over over the computer screens. We've also added seven emergency phones with public address systems in functionality at the Medical Education Building campus for use in the medical district. We've integrated, as I said earlier, a residential on-campus cable TV and student radio stations. So we are trying, we're successfully building this functionality in which it's redundant. If we don't get you one, we'll get you another. We continue to look at new technology as it emerges on how we can best make notifications to our communities. For grants and outreach, it's kind of a fun one. The department took part in a No Shave November in which I authorized the facial hair policy for the department, which basically says you can't have facial hair. And I let our folks wear facial hair for the month of November. The officers elected to donate the funds that they would save from shaving to the Ovarian Cancer Institute, whose goal is to develop an accurate test for early detection. We initially set the goal at $2,000. Within days, we had reached that $2,000 goal. As of this morning, we have reached nearly $3,000 in what we will be contributing to the Ovarian Cancer Institute. And so November's over. No more beards, but I think that we've done a good job for our community and those people who suffer from this terrible disease. I would be remiss in not recognizing UPD officer and Nevada Police Union Representative William Perez, who led this effort, as well as for the overwhelming support that we received from President Whitfield. So, President Whitfield, thank you for your support in this endeavor. Also wanted to point out, I don't think she's here, she is, in congratulating Assistant Director Jessica Moore, who is now graduated from the FBI Academy Session 281 in Quantico, Virginia. So congratulations, Jessica. Late last month, I was notified that Lieutenant Bryant Carpenter graduated from the prestigious School of Police Staff and Command at Northwestern University as well. These are our future in the department as they continue to gain these recognitions and this training that's vital for moving the department forward. Finally, I'll brag a little bit about myself. I was elected in October during the Dallas International Association of Chiefs of Police annual conference to senior executive leadership board within the university college section. So I'll be working with them over the next year at putting together some initiatives that will be important for university police chiefs throughout the nation. Thank you. As you may recall, University Police Services has taken a lead in police training throughout the Las Vegas Valley through the College of Southern Nevada's Police Academy program. Currently, we're partnering with six other agencies, as noted in this slide, and established very, very strong bonds with the Nevada State Police as well as Las Vegas Metro's training units. This year, we will have graduated 31 new police officers for these agencies, and it currently already have 34 recruits signed up for the February 2023 Academy. So we hope to double the size of folks who are going through this training next year. We're also working at a number of new initiatives, standing up a non-affiliate program, which is going to allow individuals who are not yet hired by an agency to pay for their own way through the Academy In essence, they become free agents, and then they can seek employment wherever they want to work, and they're not tied to one specific agency if they don't want to work there. We're also continuing at the urging of President Zaragoza, continuing to explore options for a feeder program from the Clark County School District to the Academy through CSN. So we would be providing additional enhanced opportunities for CCSD students who are interested in a career in law enforcement in beginning that mentoring and educational process early in their lives. The current Academy took part in an honor run on Wednesday of this week in support of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Academy Class 464. As you may have read in media reports, 25 Los Angeles County Academy class recruits were struck by a vehicle. Apparently, it was done on purpose in Whittier, leaving several with life-altering injuries. And this was our way of showing our support for that Academy class. Finally, be on the lookout for an invitation from me for the graduation of our second graduating class that will be held at the Horn Theater on the campus of CSN on January 5th at 9 a.m. As reported here at our September meeting in Elko, the department continues to struggle with vacancies. With your support, the department applied to the Public Employees Retirement System, or PERS, and was approved to designate police officer and dispatch positions within UPD is a critical shortage, which allows us to rehire PERS retired police officers and dispatchers from throughout the state without negatively impacting their PERS salary or benefits. We currently are reviewing a number of applications that we have received under this designation, so it's working. Thank you. In addition, I've been working with our congressional delegation on the passage of the Invest to Protect Act, which has received wide bipartisan support. In speaking with congressional staff on Monday, there's an effort at this point, an attempt to move this legislation through this session before they adjourn. The bill will provide funding for police departments across the country that are under 200 officers for a variety of initiatives, including officer mental health and wellness, fund body cameras, and assist departments in recruitment and retention by providing grants for those purposes. Last month, the department hosted our first retreat in which all employees took part in team building exercises, and a number of employees received awards for life-saving, outstanding achievement, exceptional service, meritorious service, and various work during the COVID pandemic. Finally, the future. Where do we go from here? We have a plethora of issues that are facing our department, you know, continuing demands of calls for service. Growth. I think growth is great, and I'd love to see all of the additions, but it does place a demand on police services that we will be working our way through. Societal changes, things happen in the real world, and it affects us directly. And so as we move forward, what other societal changes will take place that will affect us? Emerging trends, obviously recruitment and retention, as I discussed in September at the board meeting. I don't anticipate that recruitment and retention will be resolved anytime soon. I'm thinking it'll be at least 5 years, maybe longer, before we can be in a really good spot. So that concludes my report. But before I'm done and sit down, I wanted to wish the best for those members of the board who are going to be leaving this board. Like I said earlier, I've been here 21 years. Your support of police services over the years has made our campuses safe and our students safe. And I thank you for that. You have supported me every step of the way, every single time I have come here. I will miss you. For those newly elected regents, I look forward to working with you as well to continue to protect Nevada's future. Thank you. I'm available for any questions.
Yes, Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Chief. And it's not so much a question, it's just looking at that last slide. And I know it took us many years to get to the point of consolidation, and you did a great job of consolidating the North and getting those activities in place. And that has expanded out to Great Basin and Western, and I think we've got great operations going there. And then you came down here and did the same down here. I would be leery of trying to do the statewide option, as I mentioned when we got those reports a while back, because I think they're just different entities. And I think, you know, like down here, your interaction with Metro is more important than anything that you would do with Washoe County School District or Washoe County Sheriff's Department or Elko. I think you and Southern Command working with Metro is the most important thing for the safety in this valley and for the students here. So I won't be here, of course, but my recommendation is I think that we've got the model where it is and where it's working great. And you guys are running the North and South Command great and working together well. And I would just stick with where we are. I think it's gotten into a very good place. And I would hate to throw in another layer, you know, finding somebody who reports to Dell that he doesn't want to reporting to him. He left the room. Dang it. Anyway. Just my two cents. I think the Northern Command and Southern Command have developed very well and are working great and are working with the local agencies great. And I just think a statewide mix would muddy the waters. So my recommendation to my colleagues who will be here is let it run.
Yes, Regent Moran.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Chief Garcia, I've got to tell you, you've done a phenomenal job with very little resource during a very, very difficult time when really public safety is of paramount importance. So I, again, and I'll echo the remarks made by Regent Geddes as well. You know, looking at consolidation in general, not too many people know what it takes on the inside to move a successful, seamless, and well-choreographed consolidation. You did that in the North. You did that in the South. I remember going back to 1973 and hearing stories of Metro's consolidation with the Sheriff's Department. And at that time, their budget was $8 million. And the cost of consolidation was somewhere in the realm of, I think, $300,000 or $400,000. They spent $10,000 repainting cars. I want to say that they also spent another $15,000 on making sure that the uniforms were all consistent and compatible with one another, so the officers all had the same look. But I think the weapons part was $285,000, if I remember correctly, from stories I've heard, which was the biggest item in that transition budget. But, you know, the most difficult part was the fact that you were corralling cats. You know, people get territorial. And to be able to work through that, as I said, seamlessly and comfortably, professionally, was really something that I would take my hat off. My family has been in law enforcement for many, many years, and so we do kind of know a little bit about that. And what you did was really incredible, and it took someone of your stature at a time and place to make that happen. And so, again, I looked forward to working with you when you came on board, and I'll miss working with you when I leave, and it's been a pleasure, Chief. Thank you very much for everything that you've done here for the state, for our residents, and for the board in general.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Go ahead, Regent Carter.
I'll be real brief, but I just want to say I do appreciate you being so responsive. You know, I think one of our earliest conversations was I went to a game at the basketball, you know, stadium over here, and there was an old, rusty police car there. And it was just the image of like, really, is that the best image we can put going forward? And so I appreciate that, all that change you've had. But I also just want to refresh our memory, too, that you pursued grants. So you didn't just live with what you had. You actually went out there and tried to get grants and tried to help us do things. I believe that bought the screeners, whatever they're called, the metal detectors or whatever. But thank you so much for being responsive, and thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
Are there any other? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just echo what my colleagues have said, that you've done an extraordinary job when in the north and then now in the south, and I really do appreciate that. I recall from the presentation of the IACLEA report that there was, it seemed to me, that there was an appetite for further consolidation.
He's the one that...
I would like to see us just explore that, to see what the options are, if there are parts to this that may be enhanced, or if there are opportunities that a further consolidation might lend itself to us. So I think it would be worth the effort to at least explore that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Regent Tarkanian, did you have a comment?
I've just been so impressed by so much that's been done. And I'm most appreciative, as I know many others are.
Thank you. And I have one question. As far as the canine force, have we recruited any new additions?
We have one vacant canine position. So as we continue to fill the vacancies we have, my intent is that we fill that last vacancy. But we're also looking at something that Northern Command did that I've been very, very impressed with. And I spoke with my colleague at the University of Illinois, who have brought on board comfort dogs to their departments. They've been very, very successful in helping deal with victims and those that are involved in crimes. So, it's kind of a two-step process. We haven't hired anybody. We still have three. We're going to get the fourth one hopefully within the next year and then move to the comfort dog program, which, again, is met with huge success across the country.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Again, are there any additional questions? Hearing none, we will move on to...
Chair, I'm sorry, Chair. We also have Eric James, Director in the University Police Services North, to present also.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know, University of Arito North of Command. Good morning, Chair members. I'm going to keep mine short. Everything that you just saw from Director Garcia's presentation, it's a lot of the same things we're seeing. Same calls for service are going up. Everything is going up. Yes, we have an amazing dog named Aspen. Come on over. You can meet Aspen. We continue to fall to the same pitfalls that recruitment and hiring are our number one problem. 2016, we consolidated with TMCC, and then we sort of moved out from there with WNC, DRI, all the way out to GBC. And so we've had a lot of success with our consolidation across the board. We've instituted some other new programs as well. Looking at the model that WNC had, we now have community service officers on the university main campus, TMC main campus. All of our campuses now have community service officers as well, which just add another approachable level to the officers. Some people don't like to necessarily speak with officers, so this is an opportunity for them to speak with someone else. It's also a great pipeline for us to hire new employees. And so we just hired a new CSO in July, and now he's already going to the academy in January. So we're already seeing a pipeline for hiring for us as well. And to sort of just piggyback, one quick story of the therapy dog was yesterday, while Lauren was out playing catch with Aspen, a young lady who was distraught came over crying. And within 2 hours, we had not only provided her with food, a place to stay, but it was one of those, there is no way that she would have approached anyone, especially our victim advocate, if she didn't see the dog. And so that dog has just leaps and bounds helped us tremendously. So I'm here to answer any questions. I know, I believe President Helgerson said brevity, and that's why I'm going to keep it. So if I can answer any questions, please let me know.
No questions? Good. Yes.
I loved working with Chief Garcia, but I equally love working with Chief Eric. He does an amazing job. I think one of the things that he didn't say is the choice of officers placed at our college campuses, speaking for TMCC, is fantastic. They are wonderful officers. They are can-do people with great attitudes, and the students and I think most of the employees really love working with them. So thank you, Chief James. I appreciate you.
No other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And now we'll move on to agenda item number 6, new business. Is there any new business in ELCO?
There is none.
Thank you. New business in Reno?
There is none in Reno.
Thank you. And is there any new business in?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit of new business. Can the board participate in that exercise wherever it's deemed appropriate, the exercises that are going to be taking place with the UPD? And also, signage on campus, when you talk about emergency preparedness, knowing where to go is pretty, like if they say shelter in this place, there should be maps that are generated by your phone with a QR code so that anybody can QR code it and get directions directly on their phone so they can get to that place of shelter safely and quickly. And I don't know if that falls under here or another department, but is that something we can look into? And lastly, I'd like to echo what Regent Carvalho said about exploring the further consolidation of the UPD. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. So a couple items for the board's consideration. The single biggest thing that you can do to secure your network is from users is to have two-factor authentication. So I think at the very least this board, the system office, should explore what they can do for our direct employees, if not system-wide, what that would be. And the other item for consideration would be, you know, SCS access and ISP, System Computing Services access and Internet Service Provider, to a whole bunch of different really small places across the state, from libraries to healthcare, hospitals, whatever. It seems like maybe we have a role in coming up with some basic cybersecurity protocols or guidance where SCS could be helpful to the people that are already on our network, and that seems like something that could probably be a grant as well that we could probably apply for. But do those two things to explore. Thanks.
Thank you. Any new business still in Las Vegas? No additional new business? All right, then we'll move on to agenda item 7, public comment. Is there any public comment in ELCO?
There is no public comment in ELCO.
Thank you. Public comment in Reno?
And there is none in Reno.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, this security committee is adjourned.